Thank you very much, and thank you for this nice invitation. I'm really, you know, very happy to be here and to be talking about some of my actually earlier stuff. Actually, these are things that I, you know, usually I worked like some time ago, but from time to time, occasionally I come back to this topic about explanation of some non-local correlations in entangled states. So I think, as we all know, entangled states are a treasure trove for philosophers, I mean, metaphysicians of science, lots of interesting things going on from a metaphysical point of view. And I think one of the most, one of the best known features of entangled states is basically the existence of those spooky correlations that defy spatial separation between, you know, separate systems. So regardless of how far in space those systems are, there is some sort of correlation that cries out for some causal explanation, and yet there are some problems with finding those explanations. So this is exactly what I would like to explore in this talk, just to try, under certain assumptions, of course, because it's virtually impossible to do anything without making some assumptions. Under certain assumptions, I would like just to propose some possible ways of explaining, causally explaining those correlations. Well, ultimately, the proposal will fail because I'm going to argue that it is impossible to find a reasonable causal explanation. Nevertheless, I think the reasons why these explanations fail are kind of interesting in their own right. So this is what I would like to do. This is the plan of my talk. So roughly speaking, of course, I'll start with some introductory remarks and some assumptions. Then I will move on to the issue of explaining counterfactual conditionals in the context of space-like separated events. Why is it so? Because actually I will be following the particular conception of causality, which is counterfactual conception of causality, of course, dating back to David Lewis, going back to David Lewis. So, of course, I will have to explain a little bit how I would like to interpret counterfactual statements in the context of relativity, sort of, you know, relativistic space-time. Then we will focus on so-called alternative outcome counterfactuals, which precisely like underpin possible causal links that happen in quantum entangled states. I will discuss possible interpretations of these counterfactuals and also conclusions regarding the possible causal links. Then we will just explore some issues related how to interpret quantum states in a dispositional and counterfactual way. Finally, this is the sixth point, is sort of like the main thing. I will sketch three causal models that can be proposed in order to potentially explain what's going on in these correlations. And also I will disclose what I consider as their most important shortcomings of these models. These shortcomings will be here discussed as objections, and finally I'll draw some conclusions. Okay, so this is the plan of the talk. So let's get started. Let's start with some basics, rudimentary things that hopefully everybody should be familiar with. A typical case, the standard case that philosophers usually discuss, is an entangled state of two half-spin particles, such as electrons. Of course, there are many more, but this is like the best-known case of the so-called spin, single spin state, in which you have this weird entanglement, superposition of spins up and down in a particular direction, in the z direction. And we know that according to the rules of quantum mechanics, this state, together with implies the existence of certain correlations, perfect correlations, and these correlations can be presented in the following way, as the existence in the form of this equivalence. The equivalence is such, so So if we measure spin in this direction, that direction on both particles, then it turns out that there's these outcomes will be always anti-correlated. I mean, if the result of one measurement gives you spin up, the other one has to give spin down, and vice versa. So there's this equivalence here. I think we should stress that this equivalence, the regularity expressed in equivalence number one, is first of all, it's we believe that it's not accidental. It's something. I mean, it's somehow rooted in some nomic features of the world. So it's nomically necessary. We put it that way. And also, we have to keep in mind that it's independent of the spatiotemporal separation or locations or separations between these measurements. Okay, so now, of course, I should perhaps mention in passing that this is what our theory tells us to be the case. Of course, from an experimental point of view, from an empirical point of view, we know that these the equivalences of that sort are only true within a certain margin of error. That's obvious. I mean, so we have to remember this is some sort of an idealization. I mean, in real life experiments, these things are confirmed, but only within a certain margin of error, which, you know, this comes from the fact that, of course, detectors have certain efficiencies, that there's certain, you know, number of erroneous indications or whatever. So obviously, we're just taking this as a prediction of our best theory. Reality may be a little bit more complex than that. Okay, now, so the main question that I would like to pose in this talk is, roughly speaking, can we give a causal explanation for the existence of these correlations that were expressed in the equivalences of the sort I gave you on the previous slide? And, of course, in order to tackle this question, we have to adopt certain assumptions. And three basic assumptions I would like to accept here. The first assumption is that everything will be done within the confines of something that I call the standard, in scare quotes. I'll explain why I use the scare quotes. Standard collapse interpretation of quantum mechanics. So in other words, no funny business with, you know, Bohmian mechanics or Everett or, you know. It's just basically my working assumption here is to take quantum mechanics roughly the same way as a working physicist would interpret it. A working physicist with no particular interest in, you know, deep philosophical questions such as what is the measurement problem or whatever. So working physicists basically take this take quantum mechanics to be a theory which is based on the Schrödinger equation, of course, but occasionally from time to time when you measure things, then things behave not according to the Schrödinger equation, but something happens, something additional happens. Your system collapses into one particular component that corresponds to the result, to the outcome that you get. How does this happen? It's one of those mysteries of the universe that we still don't know how to explain. So I will not go into any specific interpretation of quantum mechanics. This is the first assumption that I will be making here. Now, the second assumption, a more philosophical assumption, is, as I already indicated, I will be following the counterfactual analysis of causation. Again, I admit that there's so many alternative interpretations of causation, obviously, on the market, and you could reformulate the very same question within a completely different framework, but you have to make a choice, first of all. And why do I make this choice? Well, you know, there's several reasons, more or less, like pragmatic, theoretical, whatever. One particular reason is that it seems to me that the counterfactual analysis of causation is flexible enough. It does not commit us to any specific physical mechanism of causation, because there are some alternative interpretation of causation which somehow rely on certain physical intuitions, for instance, associated with classical physics. Like, for instance, some philosophers say that the causal link has to rely on some transfer of matter of energy. But this is a very classical concept of causation. It's kind of like a little bit limited. It seems to me that the counterfactual interpretation of causation is more flexible. It doesn't actually offer us any clue as to what is the mechanism of causation. It only tells us that in order for a causal link to occur, you have to have this if this did not happen, this something else would not happen, would not have happened. Okay. And because of the flexibility, I think that this makes the counterfactual concept of causation quite suitable for the purpose of explaining something that is in its nature, in its very nature, rather non-classical, such as the purportedly possible causal link in entangled states. And the third assumption that I would like to introduce here and adopt is, if we start talking about counterfactuals, of course we have to decide what are counterfactual conditionals, and this is, again, huge topic in the philosophy of language, and of course people debate this very hotly, and there are different approaches here available, and I will be following the approach that, again, I feel that it's best suited to the task at hand, which is counterfactual as interpreted on the condition of the fixity of the past. In other words, the idea is such that in order to evaluate a counterfactual, which refers to a particular occurrence in time, we better not manipulate the past. The past is already done, the past is already fixed, nothing, I mean, can be changed there, so you take this whatever happened up until this point as given, then you add your counterfactual supposition, and then you see what will happen in the future somehow. So this is this idea. Now, of course, you can question this assumption. I think Lewis would have a lot to say about this, even though Lewis himself was particularly wasn't particularly happy with counterfactuals going back in time, backtracking counterfactuals. Still, he was equally unhappy with sort of fixing this idea by force. I mean, so he had his own approach to counterfactuals based on this intricate combination of criteria of similarity and closeness between possible worlds. There are some reasons that I think that this particular approach would not work very well in quantum mechanics, but I have no time to discuss this, so I'll skip this argument. So anyway, I would like to follow this intuition. And I'm not the only one. This is the intuition, and Tim Modlin, roughly speaking, wants to interpret counterfactuals that way, and many people, as other people as well. Okay. So the next step is spatiotemporal counterfactuals. Let me briefly discuss some possibilities, because it turns out that actually there are many, even within this general intuition of keeping the past fixed, there are still several interpretations, several ways of interpreting specifically counterfactuals, so-called spatiotemporal counterfactuals. So I would like to discuss this right now. Again, starting with this general idea, this general recipe, as I call it, which I already explained. So again, you have this event A, counterfactual event, something that you would like to counterfactually introduce into your analysis. So in other words, you would like to, roughly speaking, to evaluate the counterfactual. If A had happened, then B would have happened. Okay. So A is your counterfactual presupposition regarding a particular moment of time. You keep the past fixed. You add A, you evolve everything according to the laws of nature, and then you see whether B is true in all such scenarios or not. If it's true in all scenarios, then the counterfactual is true. If it's not true in all scenarios, then it's false. Again, it's up to you. You further down the line, you can make a choice whether you want to call all these counterfactuals in which B is not always true as false, or maybe you can say that some of them are false and some of them are just undecided. It's up to you. So it's not really important from our perspective. However, the main thing that I would like to point out right now is that in the regime of the special theory of relativity, this expression, the past of an event, is not is ambiguous. It can receive more than one interpretation, and this is what gives rise to this splitting of several possible approaches to spatiotemporal counterfactuals. And the past of an event can mean at least three things. First of all, it can mean A's absolute causal past. What is absolute causal past? The absolute causal past of an event, a point-like event, is this the entire area of space-time that can classically sort of causally affect A. Classical, I stress. In other words, there can be linked with A with the help of a beam of light, with the help of some sort of connection which propagates at the speed of light or less. So this is something that technically is called the past light cone. Let me just, can I use this just to
draw? So,
yeah, basically what we have here is, we have this spatial-temporal diagram, x, t, you choose an event A. Now the absolute causal past is something, is the past, light cone, which contains all events that actually can interact classically with A. So this is one possible interpretation of what it means to have the past of an event. The second is actually the complement of A's absolute future. Now, absolute future, again, it consists of this entire the interior of the future light cone, so all these events that actually can be classically speaking, influenced by A, by sending some signals which propagate at most at the speed of light. So the second interpretation would mean that we just take all of this as the past of A, everything which is outside, everything except what can be what can be signaled from E, what can be connected from A using a subluminal signal. So this is the second interpretation. And the third interpretation is that we can interpret A's past as something which is relative to an inertial frame of reference. We know that in the context of the special theory of relativity, depending on which in which frame of reference you perform your measurements, the set of simultaneous events will be different. The surface, the hypersurface of simultaneity will be different. And again, on this diagram, these sets of simultaneous events can be drawn as lines which can be tilted like this or like this. And depending on in which frame of reference you are, you can say that the past of A is this for area, and in another frame of reference, the past of A will consist of the area below the second line. So these are these three possibilities. And like I said, these three possibilities will give rise to three concepts of spatiotemporal counterfactuals. We have three available interpretations of spatiotemporal counterfactuals. I'll call them the following. The first one I call the narrow fixed past. Okay. The narrow fixed past is the interpretation which is based on the assumption that what we keep fixed is the interior of the past light cone of the antecedent event, and everything else we don't have to keep fixed, meaning that whatever happens, everything else has to follow from the laws. Okay, these are the laws that will tell us what will happen. The second interpretation I call the broad fixed past, which is based on the assumption that what we keep fixed is, again, this entire region outside the future light cone. And again, everything else must follow from these events plus the laws. And finally, there's this frame-dependent fixed past interpretation, in which we evaluate counterfactuals relative to frame of reference. And again, an immediate consequence of this interpretation is that counterfactuals become relative to frames of reference. In other words, one and the same counterfactual conditional can be true in one frame frame of reference and false in the other one. Okay. This is the consequence of the third approach. Okay. Now let's go back to this case, the quantum case that we're interested in. So suppose that in the actual world we have two space-like separated. So I hope everybody is familiar with the terminology what space-like separated means, of course. So we have two space-like separated measurements, and they both revealed they revealed the appropriate, their corresponding z spin values, one up, one down. This is the actual situation. And now we are interested in the following alternative outcome counterfactuals. The counterfactual, that's what I call it. The counterfactual is if the measurement on one particle L, or left-hand side particle showed the value down instead of up, then the measurement on the particle R, right-hand side particle, would show the value up. This is the counterfactual that you would like to evaluate. You would like to know its truth value depending on which interpretation will follow. Because this will be the key to finally judging whether there is a causal link between these two events according to the Lewisian conception of causation. So this is the diagram, which actually would be nice probably just to copy this diagram on this board, because then I will follow. I will just go further with the. Maybe I'll do that. Continuing with my slides, and I don't want just to skip back and forth between slides. And I will need this diagram in order to see what's going on. Let me briefly copy. So here we have the left-hand side measurement. Here we have the right-hand side measurement. We have these light cones here. And perhaps, and these two dotted lines, they indicate two possible frames of reference, two possible hypersurfaces of some identity for two possible inertial frames of reference. Okay. Good. So let's start with the first interpretation, the narrow fixed past interpretation of counterfactuals. And it is easy to observe that, according to this interpretation, the counterfactual that we're interested in is actually true. Why is it so? Because we have to keep fixed because according to this interpretation, here we have the situation. This is the actual outcome. The actual outcome is up, and here the actual outcome is down. Now we are considering an alternative scenario, this possibility that the outcome, rather than up, that the outcome would be down, counterfactual. Okay? So in order to do that, we have to keep fixed everything here, okay? And we have to follow all these nomic relations that follow nomic facts that occur in the world. So in other words, if this is down, then according to our nomically necessary equivalence that I wrote on one of my previous slides, R has to be adjusted appropriately. And because it is outside of the area that we want to keep fixed, we are free to do that, because this is what the laws are telling us. The laws telling us, if this is down, this has to be up. So the counterfactual will be true. So under this first interpretation, the counterfactual is true. However, go ahead. Good.
So what happens if I instead of doing Z dimensional
on
R, do an X
dimensional? Oh, that's a good question, but that's a different counterfactual. If you consider like an X spin measurement, then of course, this measurement can show either down or up. So neither counterfactual would come out true. So again, it's either both are false or both are undetermined, depending on how you want to. But they are not true, definitely.
More specifically, so if I did an X spin measurement and then a Z spin measurement, so
if you did X and then Z here,
so I'm worried. So my worry is that I'm allowed to change whatever I like in the back, like a bar. That's not being kept fixed. So here's a change you make, insert in between preparation and Z spin measurement and X spin measurement.
Okay.
And then the counterfactual is going to come up.
Okay, I'm not sure if I'm. My impression is that your suggestion is that suppose that in the absolute past of this measurement, there was a previous measurement.
In the past outcome of R.
Okay, we're not supposed to keep this fixed. We're supposed to keep fixed only the absolute past of the antecedent event. The antecedent event is this.
Yeah.
So here, this creates a totally different situation. If there was a previous measurement here, then of course, the state is no longer an entangled state. Something happened. So obviously we are just talking now about the totally different situations. We cannot expect that the correlations will be upheld because there's no entanglement anymore. The system has already collapsed. If you measured whatever you measured here, the system has already collapsed. What I'm interested in the situation in which the system is still entangled, and now I'm doing my measurements. So I think that this I basically I just eliminate it by the assumption that the system is entangled. Okay. Yeah. So, however, I think we should mention this, this reminder that we are working under the assumption. This is the assumption. This is something that follows from the assumption that we are following the standard collapse interpretation of quantum mechanics. We weren't working under the assumption that no outcomes are predetermined by their past. There's no common cause. Why is it so? Because I mean, why is it so important? Because if we assumed that these outcomes are predetermined, for instance, like in Bohmian mechanics or some hidden variable hypothesis. If we assume that there is some state which predetermines both results, so obviously in this situation, even if we considered an alternative outcome here, because we have to keep everything fixed here, including this purported common cause, and the common cause in turn, causally or somehow nomically, forces R to show down, then of course there would be no correlation here. I mean, even under the assumption that the result is down, here the result would still be down. Okay, this is the counterfactual situation in which we end up with a world which is law-breaking, but yeah, of course, this is a world in which there is a miracle. A miracle happened, which made the result of this experiment up, in spite of the fact the result was predetermined, made it down, in spite of the fact that this result was predetermined to be up. So obviously there's a miracle here. Nevertheless, the counterfactual comes out false. And of course, there's no causality. So under this assumption that there is a common cause, there would be no counterfactual dependence between the left-hand side outcome and the right-hand side outcome. And this is to be expected, because if you have a common cause, then the common cause effectively screens off any causal correlations between these things. Okay, everything comes down to this. But, like I said, I am excluding this from the outset. I'm following the standard quantum mechanics. Nothing predetermines this result. Nothing predetermines that result. I mean, there's nothing in this path that would tell you whether the outcome will be up or down. So under this assumption we're trying to figure out if there is a causal relation between left and right, the left-hand side and the right-hand side system. Okay. In the second approach, the broad fixed path, the outcome is actually, the counterfactual will be false. And why is it so? Why is it so?
It is so because now we have to keep fixed everything which is outside the future light cone of the antecedent event. The antecedent event, again, is that the outcome is down rather than up. And if you keep everything fixed, this includes also the result that we got here. So the result will be down. Again, this is a world in which there is a miracle, which, in other words, one way of looking at this scenario is we consider everything that is outside the future light cone of this event as belonging to the past. It's already gone. It's past. So obviously, by doing something here, I cannot affect the past. Okay. So there's no causal relation here. There's no counterfactual dependence. Whether this transfers to causality remains to be seen.
I'll later comment extensively on this. For now, we're just saying that there's no counterfactual connection in this interpretation. And finally, there's this third interpretation, the frame-dependent fixed past, according to which everything depends on which frame of reference we select. So for instance, if we select this frame of reference, this one, associated with this hypersurface of self-identity, this means that we have to keep fixed everything here, and obviously the result of this outcome does not belong to the fixed past, so we are not only free to change it, but actually we must change it according to the nomic relation. So of course the result of the right-hand side measurement will be up, and the counterfactual is true. On the other hand, if we select an alternative frame of reference in which this is the hypersurface of self-identity, R belongs to the past, it's already fixed, it's immutable, unchangeable, so even if we counterfactually introduce this result down, R will still be down, so again, the counterfactual dependence is broken. So, as you can see here, you have a clear dependence of your counterfactual statements on which frame of reference you select. Okay, now for causation. So what conclusions, what conclusions can we draw from these evaluations of counterfactuals? The first case is uncontroversial, the narrow fixed path. if we adopt this, you know, the Lewisian counterfactual analysis of causation, then we have to admit that there is a causal link between the outcome revealed for particle, for the left-hand side particle and the right-hand side particle. So in other words, yes, I mean,
because it's true that if the result was down rather than up, here the outcome would be up rather than down, so there is a causal relation between the actual outcomes, up and down. Okay. Up causes down, regardless of the fact that there is no possibility that a signal can be sent between L and R. Now, let me for a moment skip the broad fixed path approach directly to the frame-dependent fixed path. Why? Because the broad fixed path is more complex. It will require a little bit more time. The frame-dependent fixed path is kind of easy. Depending on which frame of reference you select, you end up with the conclusion that there is a causal link or there is not. Which is, of course, interesting in its own right, and I'll return to this, which means basically that the fact that the causal link exists is somehow frame-dependent. And this is something some people are somehow, apparently, they're ready to accept this, they're ready to live with this consequence. For instance, there's a recent paper in BJPS by Luke Fenton-Glynn and his co-author was... His last name was Crudel, I don't remember his first name. And in their paper, they're kind of happy to accept that causality can depend on frames of reference. To me, this is really hard to swallow. I mean, as a metaphysician, I believe, if we believe that causation is something really, really real, it cannot be a matter of perspective. I mean, if something depends on the frame of reference, then usually it's considered as not real. It's something like some sort of like artifact or some perspective, you know, some perspectival state of affairs or whatever. So I'm not very happy with causation that can disappear when you move from one frame of reference to the other. But again, it's open to debate. Okay. Now, how about this broad fixed path? This is a case that requires a little bit more attention from us. Now, on the face of it, it may look that because there is no counterfactual dependence between one outcome and the other, there's no causality either. But that's not exactly true, because as you may remember, and according to Lewis, causation is defined not directly as the counterfactual dependence, but rather as the transitive closure of counterfactual dependence, which means that it is possible. You may have two events, A and C, such that C does not counterfactually depend on A, and yet C is caused by A because there's a chain of events such that in each step in this chain of events, there is a counterfactual dependence. So you just take the transitive closure of counterfactual dependence and you get causality. Okay. So we have to consider this possibility in this case, and surprise, surprise, I will argue that it will turn out precisely that there is an intermediate event here, which actually makes the connection between the left-hand side and the right-hand side causal, in spite of the fact that there's no counterfactual dependence, which is kind of interesting in its own right. So, causality, as I said, is defined as the transitive closure of counterfactual dependence, and here we have this possible intermediate event, namely, it may be that the occurrence of a particular state of the R of the right-hand side particle actually fits the bill. That this is this event that is counterfactually dependent on the measurement on the left-hand side, and in turn, it is counterfactually connected with the outcome. Okay. So in other words, you may say something like this. Here, okay. So I measure this. I perform the measurement. The outcome is up, and the fact that I perform this measurement somehow causes here the occurrence of a new state, the eigenstate for the spin down, And the eigenstate in turn forces this outcome to be up, to be down, whatever, if the hill is up and down. Okay. So here would be this intermediate event.
Okay, however, So it seems, this is the explanation, because according to the collapse interpretation, this initial state collapses upon the measurement onto one of those two of those two separable states, up, down, or down, up, depending on the outcome on the of the on the left-hand side system, on the first system. But you see, the problem is that quantum mechanics, at least, I mean, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, does not precisely tell us at which point here on this diagram, at which point this new state occurs. This is the problem. I mean, of course, the reason for this is simple. The standard non-relativistic quantum mechanics was, I mean, was presented in the classical sort of space, you know, within the classical theory of space-time, with this sort of absolute temporal order of events. So here we are just introducing relativity, so we have to do this on our own. So basically, the problem that I'm considering right now is as follows. Here you have this measurement. Suppose that for the time being, we're not measuring here anything. We're just considering the entire history of the right-hand side particle. This is its word line. Comes from some common point of origin. And because of this measurement, we believe that somewhere along this line, this collapse must occur, must have occurred. But the question is, when exactly? There is some sort of like a gray area here, because what we really know for sure is that it didn't occur here. Because this is something that is absolutely earlier than the measurement. Before the measurement, there's no collapse. The collapse does not work back in time. So there's no collapse here. And similarly, you could argue that when you just extend this line to the absolute future, which I don't have room for showing the absolute future, that at a certain point at this absolute future, the absolute future has to be already collapsed, because the absolute future already sort of knows that the measurement occurred. But what about the gray area? The gray area is precisely space-like separated areas. What is this gray area? Do we know where exactly on this line this collapse occurs? Here or here? And I think that, I don't know, the standard formulas for quantum mechanics doesn't tell us, doesn't give us a clue. So we have to do this on our own. And my suggestion is to, again, use the conceptual tool of space-time counterfactuals. But in order to do that, we have to make another interpretation. We have to interpret quantum mechanical states using those counterfactuals, or maybe using the idea of dispositional properties as a prop, so to speak. So we will adopt something that I call a dispositional counterfactual approach to quantum mechanical states. And actually, there's nothing mysterious here. I think it is quite straightforward and intuitive. Basically, to say that a system is in the eigenstate spin up in the z direction, the eigenstate, of course, for the observable spin in the z direction, if and only if it possesses the surefire disposition to reveal the value up upon measurement. Okay, so it's like there's this disposition there already. I mean, there's this property which predetermines that the value has to be up upon the measurement. And this disposition, in turn, it seems to be reasonable to be interpreted as another counterfactual, meaning if we measured spin in the z direction, the result would be up. This is what we mean by being in an eigenstate. Okay, we know that for sure that if we measure, then the result is such and such. Now, once we made this, a clear advantage of this interpretation is that now we can deploy this, formal machinery of space-time counterfactuals in order to evaluate, in order to tackle the question of this collapse, when the collapse occurs. Okay. And again, we have to go through these three available interpretations for counterfactuals and evaluate the situation in each. So here is the spatial-temporal diagram. I can skip that. We evaluate the following counterfactual under the supposition that the L outcome is up. So again, the situation is like this. In this particular setup, we are not performing any measurement on the right-hand side particle. We just assume that at a certain point we perform a measurement on the left-hand side particle, and we assume that the result is up. And we want to address the question of what are dispositional properties of the right-hand side particle given that the result is such and such, given that the result of the left-hand side measurement is none other than up. Okay. So again, we have three approaches available. So the first one is The first one is, of course, the narrow fixed past. And the narrow fixed past approach, it turns out that this counterfactual, of course, for the space-like separated locations, is false. So it, in other words, it means that here there is no disposition, that the right-hand side particle doesn't have any disposition to show down yet. It will have this disposition when it enters the future light cone of this measurement, but not at this moment. Why is it so? Because according to the narrow fixed fixed past approach, we have to keep fixed this particular past light cone. This time, of course, the past light cone of the right-hand side particle, not the left-hand side, because we are asking the question, what would happen with this particle if I performed the z measure, the z spin, the measurement of the z spin. So I keep this fixed. But the result here, according to the assumption, is not determined by anything from the past, because it's a truly indeterministic event. So I cannot assume that in my alternative possible world, the result will be still up. It may be very well, it may be down. And this what gives me the open possibility that the outcome of this right-hand side measurement can be either down or up. Okay. So this is it's not predetermined yet what the outcome will be, because the counterfactual, and the counterfactual is false. Okay. So and under this first interpretation, here there's no collapse yet. It didn't occur yet. The broad fixed path, and this is the case which we're really interested in, is that actually the counterfactual expressing the eigenstate of, the state with fixed the fixed value of the z spin, that this counterfactual is actually true. Why? Because in this case we have to keep everything outside the future light cone of this particular potential measurement, and of course this includes the L measurement with its outcome. So if this outcome is fixed, this has no other choice but to be fixed, to be opposite. So yeah. So in this case, there is a collapse, and the state is already associated with spin down here. Okay. And finally, the third one, again, the frame-dependent fixed past is that this disposition is present in some frames but absent in others. So again, we have more of this troublesome, in my opinion, interpretation of this troublesome consequence that certain metaphysical features of the world are frame dependent. So the fact that whether the right hand side system has a particular disposition depends on from what frame of reference you're looking at things. And again, this is something that makes me quite uncomfortable, but some people are willing to live with it. Actually, to my knowledge, there are some interpretations of quantum mechanics which assume just that the notion of a quantum mechanical state has to be specifically relativized to a frame of reference. I understand that the motivation behind this interpretation comes precisely from the urge to somehow interpret what's going on in these entangled systems, but it seems to me that we have to pay too high a price for that. I mean, the price is just to admit that certain objective features of the world, or things that look like objective features of the world, are actually perspectival, are actually dependent on our perspective, which I think it's an unfortunate consequence.
Can I just double check? So the second reading, the one where it makes the counterfactual come out true, is going to be true at all points along
Yes.
Whether it's space-like to the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now the consequence, and so going back to our problem, because our initial problem was, what's with the causation under this broad fixed past interpretation? There's no counterfactual dependence, but perhaps there is causation. And now the answer is, yes, there is causation that goes through this intermediary step, which is the creation of the state, of the eigenstate of the right-hand side particle. Okay. Namely, there is a chain of events. The chain of events consists of three events. You start with the left-hand side outcome. The left-hand side outcome non-locally creates the right-hand side disposition in the form of its quantum mechanical state. So it makes it, it primes the right-hand side system, so to speak. It makes it ready to show the appropriate value down. And once the measurement is performed, the value is exactly as predetermined by the right-hand side state. So there's this chain of events. And at each step of this chain, there is counterfactual dependence, even though there's no counterfactual dependence between the first and the last. But there's this intermediate, these intermediate steps. Therefore, we conclude that actually there is a causal relation between the left-hand side outcome and the right-hand side outcome. Okay, and this can be summarized, summed up by proposing, and this is what I'm proposing here. As a result, as the main result of my discussion here is just to spell out three possible causal models or mechanisms, if you will, of the correlations which occur in entangled systems. What are these models? So the first model is based on this narrow fixed past approach to counterfactuals. And the model is such that the model tells you this. You perform your measurement on your particle, on the left-hand side particle. You get some outcome, let's say up. Now this measurement by itself does not change anything physically in the right-hand side particle, in the right-hand side system. The right-hand side system still believes, speaking figuratively, it believes that it's in entanglement, in entangled state. It still believes that it's kind of, it still has the choice of showing either up or down. However, the moment you measure, the moment you perform measurements, somehow this outcome gets wind of the other outcome. So the other outcome somehow influences this outcome, not through the state, the quantum mechanical state, but somehow directly. Okay, so this outcome somehow tells the other system, no, you better be down. You cannot be up. You are wrong, sort of. I'm speaking figuratively, but you know, that's a model. That's kind of like it. So this is the model. So the model basically tells you there is a direct and unmediated causal link between the outcome, the left-hand side outcome and the right-hand side outcome, and this direct link is responsible for what we observe as those correlate in the form of those correlations. This is the first causal model. The second causal model is based on the broad fixed past approach, and here is the story is slightly different. The story is such that your left-hand side measurement and its outcome creates physically something. It collapses the system there. This is the non-local sort of thing. Okay, it collapses there, and so regardless of whether you measure or not, physically it's already something has changed. And now the measurement only confirms it. So the outcome that you get on the right-hand side particle is kind of like does not reflect a direct link with this outcome. It rather reflects the fact that the system was already in an appropriate eigenstate, and the eigenstate was somehow forced by this measurement. So again, this is a subtle difference between these two models, and of course this difference cannot give rise to any observable effects. Both models create the exact same predictions, empirical predictions. So nevertheless, they are on this fundamental level, they're different. Okay, they portray things differently. And finally, there's this third model, and again, the third model is basically that everything depends on your perspective. In one perspective, you have a direct causal link between up and down. In the other one, you don't have this causal link. Of course, you know that you have a causal link, but going in the opposite direction. But to this, I will move shortly. I move shortly to this fact. Okay, I believe I have like ten minutes.
Fine, yeah.
10 minutes. Okay, I should be fine. So let's just talk about general problems affecting these models. And the main thing that should be at this stage, it should be rather obvious that models 1 and 2 are clearly circular. Why? Because everything can be repeated in the opposite direction. All these nice causal stories that I presented to you can be repeated. So in other words, let me just start with the first story. The first story was that the outcome that you obtain on the left-hand side directly influences and forces the outcome on the right-hand side to be the opposite. Yeah, but exactly the same using the same reason, you can claim that the outcome obtained on the right-hand side actually causes and somehow
makes the outcome on the left hand side to be up. And now, how dangerous is this conclusion? Now, it may be dangerous both from a metaphysical perspective and from a methodological perspective. From a methodological perspective, it may be like metaphysicians. I mean, you know, generally metaphysicians do not believe in symmetricity, in the symmetricity of the causal relation. Causal relation was supposed to be anti-symmetric. It's supposed, if A causes B, B does not reciprocate causing A. This is something, especially when you realize that it may give rise to the conclusion that an event causes itself. If causation is transitive, and if A causes B and B causes A, then of course A causes A, which is like sui causa, you know, this case of self-causation, metaphysically not particularly attractive. On the other hand, you may say, well, you know, these are just prejudices. I mean, you know, metaphysicians have lots of prejudices depending, I mean, which are derived from some, you know, classical intuition. So in the classical world, there is no symmetric causation. Well, maybe in the quantum world, there is. So you could try to dismiss those metaphysical worries. However, there's also this methodological worry is that if you want to explain something causally, you better not end up in a circle, in a vicious circle. This is not an explanation. I mean, maybe there is a causation, maybe there is a circular causation, but it's not an explanation. Because what? You want to explain something like, I mean, suppose you want to explain, well, again, circularity is something that makes us uneasy. And I have to admit, I'm not exactly 100% sure that this is something that, maybe it's something that we could live with, or maybe not. Because ultimately what we want to explain here is not so much why the outcome is up. Because of course the outcome could have been down. The outcome, we want to explain why is it so that each time when the outcome up is up here, the outcome here is down. And one explanation is, oh, because there's causation. Up causes this to be down. But then you say, oh yeah, but then down causes this up. And how come? So you may ask yourself this nagging question. Now, but that is truly, tell me, this outcome, was it predetermined or not? Was it predetermined or not? I mean, in a sense, yes, it was predetermined by this outcome down. In another sense, it wasn't predetermined. It was a free variable that determined this. So what I'm trying to do here is just to convince you that this is not a good causal explanation. You may want to live with, you know, in a world, you may want to live with the conclusion that the world is such that some events can mutually cause themselves. But if you call this a causal explanation, it's at best, it's a very sort of unsatisfactory explanation. Now, of course, you may want to follow model 3. Again, you would avoid circularity, but the price is, of course, as I said, you have to reduce causation and other features of which we consider as real and sort of metaphysically there as basically being merely a matter, an artifact, an appearance, because they are not Lorentz invariant, and we believe, at least I'm willing to admit, that if something is not Lorentz invariant and doesn't describe the ultimate level of reality, it's something that is kind of like, you know, only a matter of perspective. So either way, you end up with some troubles, with some problems. Okay, at the end of this talk, I don't have much time for that, but at the end of this talk, I just wanted to, for a while, to explore some further objections that you might have to those causal models, because I believe that many philosophers could come up with some general objections that no, there's no causation here at all. So I would like just to generally, to anticipate or somehow to preempt perhaps, or just to consider what possible objections to the idea of causal links, which ultimately I subscribe to. What possible objections, general objections, to the idea of the existence of those causal links, non-local and circular causal links, we may present here? And one possibility I will
tell this tell you very briefly. You could question the causal character of those correlations on the basis of the fact that counterfactual dependence may not be enough. And actually, Lewis himself came to this. Maybe he didn't come to this conclusion. Okay, I would be historically incorrect. But his latest development, his latest theory of causation, which is called influence causation, may be interpreted in such a way that actually it replaces counterfactual dependence with something more subtle, which is called the influence relation. The influence relation is roughly something that if you have two events, A and B, and if the situation is, if you have a situation such that small changes in one event are counterfactually connected with small changes of the other one, then this is a clear sign and indication that causality is involved here. And you may, and I think you make, it is possible to make a good case that in this scenario, in the in the entanglement scenario, there's no influence relation, because no matter what small change of one outcome you can think of, I mean, how can you change the measurement outcome? You can change its time, so you can make it a little bit earlier, you can make it a little later, you can make it to the left, you can make it to the right, you can sort of try to somehow, you know, vary some inessential variables associated with this measurement. And this will not change the other outcome a bit. The other outcome will stay put, will stay the same. So you may say there's no influence here. If there's no influence, there's no causation. The only trouble is, and I don't have time to go into that, a couple of years ago I wrote a paper which explains this in detail. It came out in Erkenntnis. Roughly speaking, the influence relation proposed by Lewis fails to hold in some legitimate cases of causation. So, for instance, you may have a legitimate case of causation in the following sense. For instance, you can consider the following scenario. Suppose that you have a mountain full of trees. You clear all the trees. Okay, just cut down all the trees. You just leave a bare bare mountain. And then in a couple of years, there's a heavy snowfall and there's an avalanche. So you may say that causally, you have contributed causally to the creation of the avalanche. Okay, because if there were still trees, they would stop the snow. And yet there's no possible relation of influence, because the way you perform this cutting, the temporal, when, how, with what axis, with what whatever instruments or tools, it has no no influence on the fact that the avalanche actually was created. So I think that this latest theory, Lewis theory of influence, causation as influence, is wrong. It's kind of like, for many reasons, it's wrong actually. And there's another possible. Very briefly. There's another quite interesting approach that you may want to follow. Some people can say, okay, look, here you have this entangled state. Perhaps it's true that some characteristics of these entangled subsystems, they are in mutual counterfactual relations to each other. But this does not necessarily mean that there's causation, because causation requires that these facts, that these states of affairs that we're talking about, are intrinsic, that they do not characterize relations of objects to each other, but rather they characterize their intrinsic features, intrinsic properties. And there's, as you probably are aware, because this is the metaphysics of an entanglement seminar, so you know very well that there are lots of arguments on the market claiming that in quantum entangled states, actually, subsystems are not, they don't have intrinsic properties, that everything is somehow extrinsic, that there is somehow relational or whatever. So, in other words, we would have maybe, so this is one possible objection, that we could have a case here fully analogous to the case which I have described on the slide, in which I could claim that, oh, look, I have discovered a very nice non-local correlation, because when I move away from the Eiffel Tower instantaneously changes its property of being 50 feet away from me. And of course, this is bogus, this is totally unreal, Because all these properties involved are extrinsic. I mean, the property of being 50 feet away from me is not an extrinsic property, an intrinsic property of the Eiffel Tower. So there's no real causation here. So somebody may say, hey, in quantum entangled states, the situation is perfectly analogous to that. No causation here. There's rather than causation, we have some extrinsicality here involved. And I'm actually opposed to this argument. I may not be able to fully give you my reasons. I can just skip through the slides. But I basically just take arguments one by one, purporting to show that there's this extrinsicality, and I claim that either the arguments are basically they don't convince me, or they talk about the wrong type of extrinsicality, or they're just, you know, somehow strange. The two arguments that I took from the literature, one is from Alyssa Ney's paper from 2010. Basically, she says, I mean, essentially it comes down to this question. As you all probably know, in quantum entangled states, it is possible to speak about separate states of the system, but these states will never be pure, they will be mixed states, okay? So they are not represented by rays or vectors, they are represented by density operators. So what? I mean, the density operator is as any good as any other, you know, object in quantum mechanics, and mixed states are as good as any other states. Mixed states still assign attribute to quantum mechanical systems certain probabilities, okay? The only problem is, of course, there are several problems, like Alyssa Ney, for instance, points out that in mixed states, objects do not, never possess a determinate value of any observable. True. But again, so what? So here we have a situation in which you have purely probabilistic dispositions, propensities. You don't have any deterministic disposition. But still, they characterize these systems, in my mind, intrinsically, pending further arguments, let's put it that way. Okay, so I don't see how this translates into the statement that states in quantum entangled subsystems must be extrinsic. To me, they are intrinsic. They may be not determinate, but they're intrinsic. I'll skip that. Sorry. However, just to sum up, all this discussion whether entanglement is extrinsic or not, whether subsystems in entangled states have intrinsic or extrinsic properties is actually, the point is moot, because when we follow the standard collapse interpretation, sooner or later everything will collapse, and if it collapses into separable states, into products, and products are intrinsic. I mean, and products consist of intrinsic states, okay? So even if to begin with, we started with a situation with two subsystems that don't have any intrinsic properties, By the very measurement, I create intrinsic properties, and this is causation, and this is just has to be causation. Okay, the measurements create intrinsic properties in the distant part of the system, and if that's the case, how else could you call it if not just causation? Okay, it's just causation. So my conclusion is, given the adopted assumption, it seems inescapable that there are causal links between correlated outcomes in entangled systems. Yes, I agree with that. However, no fully satisfactory causal explanation of the observed correlations can be given. And at this note, I will end. Thank you.
Thank you very much.